Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When it comes to kids, too often we tell them to sit still, stop running around, or quit squirming. But over the past few decades, kids have slowed down considerably, and it's taking a toll on their health. Today, almost 30% of Ohio's adolescents are overweight or even obese. The blame for this has been laid on parents, big fast food companies, technology, and of course, schools, where kids spend 1,000 hours a year. Joining us now is Jackie Broderick Patton. She's Wellness Initiative Coordinator for Columbus City Schools. Welcome to the show, Jackie.
Thank you, Ann. It's nice to be here.
Also with us is the Coordinator for Physical Education, Health, and Dance for the Columbus City Schools, Don Kane. Welcome, Don.
Thank you, Ann.
Jackie, you'll be part of a panel discussion at COSI. It's called Childhood Obesity Epidemic, Who Owns It? By the way, listeners, you can check our website for a link to get more information about that. What role do you think schools have played in the problem of childhood obesity, leading up to this?
I think that as high-stake testing has come into play, schools have moved further away from a rounded school day, meaning recess, times for activities, physical education programs possibly have been cut, and that we're now starting to look at that and move back to the middle. But I think we've swung to the right where our focus has been solely on academics. Possibly that could play a role.
And to what extent are schools understanding, educators understanding the relationship between physical activity and the ability to learn?
A lot of research has currently come out that supports the learning connection. And what I mean by that is that in order for children to be able to optimally learn, they need good nutrition and physical activity. And now we're understanding more and more that that plays a part in their education. And as a school district, we're responding to that that research.
In what way? Because recesses aren't going to get longer necessarily.
So we are looking at taking activity breaks. So every 60 minutes, looking for kids to get up and have an opportunity to move. We look at our recess. For instance, we have several days of indoor recess because of weather. Mm-hmm. So we're as an initiative, we're looking at indoor recess and looking at opportunities for kids still to get that large muscle movement so they're not just sitting and playing tic-tac-toe or something like that. We have worked with Molina Health and purchased indoor recess toolkits where we design those toolkits for large muscle movement, but we also combine the learning content standards. So they're having an opportunity to move and learn their ABCs or their numbers, things like that. We also are looking at our nutrition and our menus and following the federal guidelines. They are in 2013-14, those guidelines have gotten more, stringent, but they're looking at more fruits and vegetables, servings of whole grain, decreasing sodium, saturated fats, and things like that. So better nutrition.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how schools contribute to both the obesity problem among children, but also what they're doing to change that and turn around that trajectory. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Don Kane, lots of kids aren't getting the recommended amount of exercise per day anyway. I mean, there's only so much you can do with you know, movement breaks during a regular class day. Do Ohio schools have phys ed requirements anyway?
The only Ohio requirement that is out there is from the Ohio Department of Education, and that is 1/2 credit for physical education in high school.
So there's no requirement in grade school for any phys ed.
That is correct. However, we do have Ohio Department of Education evaluation assessments that just came online in 2012. And this is the second year of this new assessment. And it covers 12 different benchmarks and six standards where every second grader, fifth grader, one time in middle school, one time in high school, they go through the assessment process.
It's a physical assessment.
It's a physical and cognitive as well.
Okay.
So it's a combination of both.
If they don't require phys ed, then how can they expect districts to necessarily help the kids achieve those?
It's totally up to the school district to implement that.
When you leave it up to school districts that are short on money, how do you make the decisions about what to keep and what to let go?
It's based on their values and principles in the school district and school board.
So what is Columbus City Schools' values in regarding phys ed?
At this point, K through 5 receive 30 to 40 minutes per week, one time per week. And that's about the average across the whole nation. Across the whole nation with elementary is approximately 1.2 times per week.
Do you think that's enough?
Definitely not. With the standards of or recommendations from CDC, they recommend 60 minutes a day of physical education or physical activity. And as an example of Chicago Public Schools implemented this last year, and this is their second year.
60 minutes a day.
60 minutes a day.
Is there any sense about what kind of effect that's had?
Well, I think they have 400,000 students in that school district, so I haven't.
Much larger than much even
larger.
Columbus City Schools. Yes.
However, they have the same breakdown of free and reduced lunch
statistics. Which is about 86%?
Correct. Right.
I think it was 87 okay. that I just recently read that Chicago has. So it's okay. very similar to Columbus.
You've been active, literally, Don Kane, in teaching phys ed for many years. Have you noticed a difference in the kids that you're teaching today versus 10 years ago?
Yes, I have. I think it's yearly that we are noticing a difference, just not myself, but our physical educators that I meet with regularly. They're noticing a difference in our students to this day on physical fitness tests and just the ability to exercise and get out there and move. Currently, we offer recess during the school day at Columbus City Schools. At one time during after lunchtime, or it could be before lunch, depending on the school, and then possibly one other time. So that could be 30 minutes a day up to. And if they receive physical education, it could be another 30 minutes. So one time a week, they're receiving that 60 minutes requirement in our schools. And that's pretty typical throughout the United States with elementary. Middle schools are usually every day, depending on the school. High school, they'll receive it up to two semesters for the school year for Columbus City Schools. And they have an option of taking one of those semesters in eighth grade. So they may only receive physical education one time during their high school years.
But the way the system is structured now, a lot of kids think they're better off taking an AP class than a phys ed class because they get credit for it and it shows up on their grade card. The same goes for music and that kind of a thing. Problem?
It's definitely a big problem with our kids just not there anymore. You know, when we were kids, we got on our bicycles and went outside and rode around on the bikes. Well, kids do not do that anymore. They don't go running and biking anymore. They're sitting and playing video games or on a computer or cable television. And that's not going to change. This is the 21st century. So we have to utilize all that time they have during a school day, before, during, and after.
Yeah, technology, big elephant in the corner, obviously. It's not necessarily going to change, so
right.
It's how to work around it. In 2011, Columbus Schools adopted a wellness initiative, strategic vision plan for the next 4 years. So we're 3 years down the road. How close is the school, Jackie, the district, I should say, to achieving those goals?
That's a very good question. We work, my job specifically is funded out of that wellness initiative. And we use the coordinated school health model to, we have five committees: communication, PEPA, nutrition, school health services, and school climate. And then we look at what we're doing as a district and policies, setting policies in our district or recommendations in our district of best practices. For instance, birthday celebrations, using alternatives other than cupcakes and cake, pencils, erasers, healthy celebrations.
Wait a minute. You mean get pencils instead of a cupcake? No, I don't think so.
Right. It's a hard sell.
What's celebratory about that?
It's a hard sell. I understand. But when you think about all the opportunities kids have these days to eat junk food or sugar-laden foods with fats, there's a lot more of that than when we were kids.
Right.
So we feel that we have 51,000 students who are a captive audience, and that we need to be promoting healthy eating. You could have a birthday celebration 5 days a week in a school. On top of that, kids in their environment are having, you know, opportunities to eat junk food more often. So we're really looking at opportunities in our school system and policies. For instance, we were one of the first schools in the nation to have water-only vending. We also have salad bars at our schools where kids are able to have unlimited fruits and vegetables.
Are they using those?
That's a good question. With a little guidance, yes, but we have to look at, for instance, if we serve an orange to a grade school child, are they going to actually peel it and eat it?
Right.
So we're cognizant of that. We have parent groups who come in at Clinton Elementary School. They're called the Fruit Ninjas, and they actually help prepare and cut up those fruits for students to eat. So we are aware of it's available, but are kids eating it? Our younger kids, with a little encouragement, tend to eat it. Our high school kids, especially our older kids in 10th and 11th grade, miss the old menus with the fried food and
tater tots.
Yep. And, you know, they're a little less likely to get on the...
Because they came up through a different system.
They came up through a different system.
So you're expecting to see changes 2 or 3 years down the road then with the kids as they enter high school.
Exactly.
Who grew up in the system.
As it becomes a norm, that's what they're used to. And we're also looking at ways to increase participation, especially in breakfast, because nationally... breakfast participation tends to be lower than lunch. About 80 kids who, or out of 100 kids who eat lunch, about 80 of the goal is to have 80 of those kids eat breakfast at school, because we know that supports their learning and their health. Right now, the average is about 51 to 100. So as a district, we're looking at ways of increasing that participation. And that might be... Serving breakfast after the school day starts, grab and go breakfast, different ways of having more kids participate as a way of getting a healthy meal. We also are working with our after school programs, offering healthy snacks, and a lot of those programs, that's the last meal our kids have in the day. So we're looking at that as an opportunity to help kids. Have a better diet.
Don Kane, Jackie mentioned parents coming in and helping out with food and helping kids, you know, eat properly in the lunchroom. What about physical fitness? To what extent can you involve parents in this process of making physical fitness a regular part of their day?
Just like we are with the nutrition piece, with starting the kids out in elementary, that's what we're doing in elementary school as well, because we have a licensed physical educator in each building, and they are following health-related fitness. It is a curriculum called Fitness for Life, and we have that K through 12. So we're seeing the beginning signs of following those same standards and benchmarks that we're actually assessing as well, and they're continuing that with our physical educators. So now we are all on the same, same sheet of music across the whole board of in all the school districts doing the same thing in Ohio. And we're one of the few school districts or few states that actually has an assessment piece like this. So it is very comprehensive with each grade level as they go through K through 12.
We're running out of time, but I did want to bring up an issue that a lot of people will say, why aren't they playing in more sports? Why aren't they more active that way? When you're in a school district where 86% qualify for free breakfast and lunch programs. That's not necessarily, and in a day and age when fees for participation keep going up, how are kids supposed to do that? How can they keep up and do the sort of things that are fun, you know, playing games and learning sports that they could have for life?
That's a very good question. I was just at a function this morning with Ohio Department of Transportation and the Safe Routes to School
right.
at Ohio Avenue promoting biking and walking to school. And as the children came up, we had bikes and helmets. We weren't giving away bikes. We were giving away helmets. We wanted to have helmets available for kiddos who didn't have them, who were riding their bikes. Mm-hmm. And so in asking the children, you know, do you have a bike at home? Several, I would say 9 out of 10 said no. And then the second question, do you have a helmet when you ride your bike? Inevitably, the question was no. So there is a disparity with our urban youth and opportunities. We work with a lot of community partners in order to try to address that. Giving away bike helmets. We just had tricycles donated to our pre-K classrooms for our students to use. But there's a disparity. I don't know. I think it's a complex issue. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any one answer. But a public-private partnerships, we do a lot of work to bring those types of opportunities to our children.
Jackie Broderick-Patton, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jackie Broderick-Patton, she is the Wellness Initiative Coordinator for Columbus City Schools. Also with us, Don Kane, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Don Kane, he's Coordinator for Physical Education, Health, and Dance for Columbus City Schools. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. A few years ago, HIV was the deadliest chronic viral infection, taking about 13,000 lives per year. But another chronic virus has overtaken HIV as the leading cause of death by infection, hepatitis C. It attacks the liver, can go for years undetected, and each year kills about 15,000 people. There are some promising new drugs on the market, but they cost an eye-popping $1,000 per pill. That's been raising questions about who gets treated and who pays the bill. Joining us now is Kaiser Health News correspondent Julie Appleby. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Christopher Walker, Director of the Center for Vaccines and Immunity at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks, Anne. It's nice to join you this morning.
How does hepatitis C work, Christopher, once it's in the body? Why is it not detected more quickly?
That's a good question. So historically, if you look back, the virus was discovered about 25 years ago in 1989. And at that time, many people who received blood transfusions developed liver disease and the cause was unknown. So HCV was identified as the cause of hepatitis. Now, with the discovery of the virus, we could screen people and understand a little bit about how this works. And what we know now is that about 25% of people, about 1 in 4 who are exposed to this virus, develop strong immunity and clear it naturally. They never have a problem with the virus again. But about 3 people out of 4, 75%, develop a lifelong persistent infection with the virus. They can't clear it from the liver. And the liver is producing about 1 trillion new viruses per day. So over time, liver disease develops, serious disease in some cases, cirrhosis and liver cancer. And the goal is really to stop the replication of that virus. The body can't do it naturally. We need drugs to do that. And so that's really how this works.
And Julie, what in the past, how has the disease been treated? What were the approaches there?
You know, for many years, there were a couple of drugs, interferon and ribavirin, that people used. And from what I've read, those were effective in about half the patients with the most common genotype of hepatitis C. Then a couple of years ago, some new direct-acting antivirals came on the market, and those had a better success rate for folks. I've seen some figures saying around 70% were cured. Those were expensive drugs in themselves, but then just last year, two new drugs came on the market. One's called Sovaldi and one's called Elicio, and the clinical studies seem to indicate that they may be curative in about 90% of people. And these, are the drugs that are very, very expensive. They're $84,000, for example, for Sovaldi, and they usually have to be used in combination with some other treatments, so the cost is even higher than that. And many people still have to take interferon, which is a difficult drug to take.
It's very difficult for lots of people to take. A lot of the same people that suffer from hepatitis C can't take it because of related reasons.
That's correct. And there's some new drugs that are expected to be on the market this fall that may and next year that may not require the use of interferon. Okay. So this leads to this really interesting debate right now about whether people should get these new drugs that came on the market late last year that are very expensive, or whether some people could wait to see if products come on the market soon that don't require the use of interferon. We don't know how much those are going to cost. They may actually cost more. But there is this big debate right now, and I think that's what's so interesting about these new drugs is to spark this debate about whether some patients should be asked to wait or required to wait or may choose to wait to see what else comes out on the market.
Christopher Walker, why in the world does a drug cost $85,000 a year, $1,000 a pill?
Well, the one thing I would point out is that we've had the virus since 1989, and we've been trying since that time to develop these direct-acting drugs that Julie mentioned, and it's been an extremely long, hard road. Many failures of the direct-acting drugs along the way because of toxicity and heart disease. Many of them have been discarded. So the investment has been huge over a very, very long period of time for these companies. I think you also have to weigh the cost against the long-term consequences of the disease. Again, the virus is the leading cause of liver transplantation in the U.S., a very expensive procedure. And with cirrhosis and potentially cancer as the outcome. I think that these factors all sort of weigh on pricing for this drug, for this disease.
Why are so many baby boomers infected?
That is related to two factors. One, before 1992, with the discovery of the virus, we did not have effective screening of the blood supply. So your chances of infection were quite high if you received a blood transfusion before that time. Also, I think a culture of needle sharing and intravenous drug use spread the virus in that era. Unfortunately, I think we're back in a new era of that now, and we have a new emerging infection in young adults and children. So that will be a problem as well
with
treatment.
With the heroin.
That's exactly
right.
Correct. Yes.
Julie Appleby, let's talk about that debate. Who can afford these expensive drugs? What do we know about the haves and the have-nots right now?
Well, first of all, these are not the most expensive drugs on the market. There are other drugs that are more expensive, and these are curative. So that's why this debate is so interesting, because these are curative. They don't just ease symptoms or extend life by a few months, right? So that's the debate. We've got insurers are now deciding who's going to get these drugs and when, and it varies. Many private insurers, the kind that you have through your job, basically, are covering these drugs. They often set some restrictions. You must, for example, maybe have it prescribed by a specialist. There may be some follow-up. You might have a test 4 or 6 weeks in to see if it's working, to see if you're actually taking them. There may be some restrictions like that. Some insurers are requiring people to try other treatments first. Not very many, but some are. Now, when you get over to Medicaid, which is the state federal program for the poor, many of those programs are trying to do this on a case-by-case basis. They haven't necessarily set all their ground rules yet. They may well be most affected by this because a lot of people who have this condition are either uninsured or are low income, so they may end up on Medicaid. So many of them are taking on a case-by-case basis, and some of them are following different guidelines. So, for example, a group of medical specialists have come out in January, and they broadly recommended the use of these drugs for almost all hepatitis C patients. They didn't set any patient sort of selection criteria. Mm-hmm. They say they're going to. Just last month, the Veterans Administration folks came out with some recommendations, which are voluntary, but they parse it a little bit more. They say these drugs are very good. They can be used for a lot of different patients, but they also say that folks with perhaps mild liver damage could perhaps wait to see if other treatments come on the market. So some Medicaid insurers are looking at that and saying maybe that's what they're going to do as well. They're going to give it to folks who have moderate to severe liver damage first and then see what happens down the road.
Christopher Walker, what about the ethical implications of telling some people they have to wait?
Well, I'm not an ethicist, but with regard to this disease, it can progress very slowly over a number of years or decades, and it can be a silent disease, and many people that are infected don't know it, and that's the big problem. We probably have many people in the country that at this point haven't been tested and are infected. I think that around that people can wait. And some people are actually choosing to wait to see if the all-oral interferon-free combinations come available. And those are on the horizon. There's no doubt that within the next 18 months the landscape will change rather dramatically again, where there will probably be two or three competing products that are interferon-free finally for most people. And so a lot of people are choosing to wait at this point because they can't.
Go ahead,
and if
Julie.
I could also add, the cost, your insurance company may cover it, but you still have to pay a copay, and that
right.
could be quite substantial in many cases. And in fact, some of these drugs are considered what's called specialty drugs, and you mm-hmm. might have to pay a percentage of the cost. So if you're paying, 20% of the cost of a $1,000 a day pill, that's a lot of money. You're going to hit yeah. your out-of-pocket maximum pretty quickly. So it can be quite expensive for even insured folks. Now, the drug manufacturers themselves are saying that they've got some programs to help people pay those copays, but still, it can be quite expensive.
So the rates for hepatitis C are highest among low-wage earners and veterans, right? There is a dichotomy here. These are people who are going to not have the best coverage, maybe Medicaid, maybe nothing at all. And I was wondering about the Affordable Care Act and what its coverage is for this kind of a medication. Do you know that, Julie?
It's going to vary by insurer, so that's why you're seeing, the different insurers coming up with their guidelines for this.
Okay.
And again, a lot of them are covering it kind of on a case-by-case basis. But the reason I think this is raising so many eyebrows is not just that it's $1,000 a pill. That's, there's mm-hmm. a lot of expensive medicine out there, but that there's potentially, 3 million people or so that might want to seek treatment. So if you multiply that out at the average cost of like $100,000 each, and that's including some of the other drug treatments, and maybe they have to take the drug for twice as long as average mm-hmm. or that kind of thing, you're looking at $300 billion, which is approximately what we already spend in this country on all drugs combined.
Right.
It's a lot of money.
Christopher Walker, if this is a cure, if these expensive, the Sovaldi and the Olysio are cure pills, would there be any advantage in taking them earlier in the disease and curing it faster? Is there a relationship there?
Well, the rate of at which you develop liver disease can vary very dramatically from person to person, from a very short few years to decades. In fact, some people may die of other causes and live a natural life, but. Mm-hmm. I think that it's highly case-dependent, almost certainly.
And when you say case-dependent, is that a genetic thing, or is that a lifestyle issue, or a combination?
There are a number of different factors. So alcohol use will accelerate. Males, it seems to be faster than females. Age, there are a number of factors that seem to determine how quickly disease will develop. I think the people that would benefit from therapy now are those who have advanced disease, have failed current therapy, and these new drugs really have the potential to cure in those very, very difficult populations. Some of the new combinations that are ahead for licensure at this point can cure between 96 and 99% of those difficult cases even, something that we didn't think would be possible just a couple of years ago.
When do we expect the new guidelines to be established and out there?
The landscape is complicated right now for drug treatment, but the FDA has given these drugs sort of breakthrough status, which speeds the approval process. And I think that we're hopeful that the approvals will come through, you know, certainly sometime within the next 18 months. So that's the reason a lot of people are waiting, too, especially the people with the HCV type that still requires interferon.
And as far as those who, you said some 25% of those exposed develop a strong immunity and clear it up naturally. How does one know if one, is there a way to test for that?
Yes. Well, first, for most people that have this infection that have acquired it, clear it without ever knowing they've had it. It is very, very mild. The symptoms are often unrecognizable to people. But we can test for the presence of the virus in blood. Mm-hmm. And if somebody's had an exposure event, they can be followed and we can just track the virus and see if your body clears it or not. Yeah.
Are there people who can have the virus but never develop the symptoms of the disease? Carriers, I guess.
Certainly there are people that manage very well with this infection for very long periods of time, but the risk is that you never really know, and so treatment is always the best option.
Okay. Well, Julie Appleby, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
Julie Appleby, she's a Kaiser Health News correspondent, and Christopher Walker, thanks to you.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Walker, he's director of the Center for Vaccines and Immunity at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Anyone who watched television in the 1980s, and there weren't a lot of alternatives back then, so you kind of had to, you probably remember these famous milk commercials.
Milk's about the best thing I can drink right now to help me build strong arms,
powerful legs, and a broad chest. And when all my work is done, will you love me just for my body?
I can live with that.
Milk, it does a body good.
The calcium found in milk has long been touted as an important nutrient for anyone who wants strong bones, but milk is not the greatest source of calcium, and calcium is not the only ingredient necessary to toughen your tibias. Joining us now for more on how to prevent bone loss and much other nutrition news is chef, author, and the podcaster known as the Nutrition Diva, Monica Reinagle. Welcome back, Monica.
Hi, Anne. Great to be with you again.
So calcium isn't so important for bone strength. Have they been lying to us all these years?
Oh, hang on. No, I think calcium is very important for bone strength. It's certainly, you know, it is the primary mineral in our bones. But, you know, as you may know, May is Osteoporosis Awareness Month. So we're kind of talking a little bit more about this. And I think sometimes we get focused on calcium to the exclusion of other factors that help us build strong bones. So it's really just about backing up a little bit and, you know, taking a look at that larger picture.
And when we talk about calcium, we often think of it in terms of dairy products, but that's not necessarily the best way to convey the nutrient into our bodies.
Well, you know, there is a lot of calcium in dairy products. It's a very concentrated source of calcium, and the calcium is very absorbable from dairy products. So, and our culture, for better or for worse, you know, is definitely dairy-centric, right? So we hear a lot about dairy products, but it's just important to remember that it's not the only way to get calcium. We get calcium from vegetables, from nuts, from beans and grains, and sometimes people don't realize that there are a lot of foods in the diet that are a good source of calcium.
So back to that Osteoporosis Awareness Month theme, why should we be worried about bone loss? Who is at the greatest risk?
Well, women tend to suffer from osteoporosis earlier in life than men do. You know, when men get old enough, they also sometimes have a risk of thinning bones and everything that goes with that, right? The increased risk of fractures and that sort of thing. But we see it more in women because after menopause, when the estrogen levels drop in our bodies, the bone loss accelerates. And so it tends to strike us sooner. But, you know, Anne, there's an irony here. The time of life when it's most important to really make sure you're getting enough calcium are in your teens and 20s, because that's when you're sort of making the deposits in that calcium bank that you're then going to draw on later in life. But most women don't really start getting nervous about calcium until they're in their 40s and 50s, right? And that's when they start to, well, sometimes it's because a mother or an aunt, an older aunt, will have a break, and all of a sudden it becomes very real, and we start getting nervous about calcium. And so the people that seem to be getting the most calcium are women in midlife. And unfortunately, this isn't a situation where you can double up now to make up for what you didn't get earlier.
What about calcium supplements? Are they helpful, or is it, like a lot of things, better to get it from the food you eat?
Definitely better to get it from the foods you eat for a couple of reasons. One, because as we said a couple minutes ago, calcium is not the only nutrient that we need for strong bones. Mm-hmm. And when we're getting calcium from whole foods, we're more likely to be getting a lot of those other accessory nutrients like boron and vitamin D and magnesium and vitamin K. But there's also recent research, a few studies have shown that women who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who are taking high-dose calcium supplements, mm-hmm. not only is it not making up for that, you know, for the our misspent youth, but it's actually increasing the risk of heart attacks. So you don't want to overdo it with a calcium supplementation. You want to take just enough to close the gap, if there is one, between the amount of calcium you need to be taking in and what you're getting from your diet. And for most women, that's going to be more in the range of 250 to 500 milligrams of calcium. But I bet a lot of your listeners are taking 1,000 or 1,500 milligrams every day.
Okay, so they're overdosing.
Well, they're not improving their chances, and they may be putting themselves at risk. So, definitely.
Why is there the heart attack connection? What's that about?
Well, you know, calcium does a number of things in the body, and one of the things it does is regulate heart rhythms and, you know, works in concert with other minerals in the body. And one theory, we're still figuring this out. This is kind of a new discovery. Mm. One theory is that when you're getting too much calcium circulating through your bloodstream, it can start to cause calcification in the arteries, you know, and that can start to cause heart problems. So, you know, it's that old Goldilocks scenario. You want to make sure you have enough, but you don't want too much. You want it just right.
My guest is Monica Reinagle. She's chef, author, and star of the podcast The Nutrition Diva. If you have a question or comment about nutrition for Monica, can be about anything, I think, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Finally, on the topic of calcium and bone strength, is there stuff that we're eating that's bad for our bones? Eating, consuming, I should say, drinking or eating, that's bad for our bones?
Well, there are certain things that we eat that can cause us to lose more calcium in the urine, things like salt, a high salt diet, or eating a high protein diet, and phosphates from colas, even diet colas contain phosphates that can increase the amount of calcium we're losing. Now, that's a problem if you're not taking in enough calcium, and the best way. So in addition to kind of watching those things, you also just want to make sure, as we just said, that you're also eating a lot of calcium from food sources to compensate for that. But, you know, it always comes back, right, to trying to cut back on the processed foods and the junk foods and the snack foods and trying to fill that plate instead with the whole foods and the fruits and vegetables and minimally processed foods.
And I know you're a nutritionist, but what about exercise?
Right. Well, of course, nutrition and exercise go hand in hand, so I do end up talking a lot about it. And that's the other, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Anne, because that's the other thing we forget to put into that a strong bone equation, and that's the weight-bearing exercise, getting out there and taking that walk, even riding bikes or doing some strengthening exercises also. And that is a great way for women in midlife to be strengthening bones. That's going to do you a lot more good than doubling or tripling up on your calcium supplements.
How does strength training help with bones? I get the connection between muscles, but what's happening to make a bone stronger because you're doing, you know, push-ups?
Well, when you're doing exercise, you put that bone under stress, you know, in that positive sense, and then the bone responds to that stress by strengthening, you know, by calling for more of the cells that that build bone muscle. So it's really just, it's very similar to muscle. When we put that muscle under stress, it responds by getting a little bit stronger, and that's what's happening with our bones as well.
Anita in Grove City, you're on the air with Monica Reinagle. Hi, Anita. Anita, you're going to have to turn down your radio.
Okay. Okay. Yep.
You're on the air.
Hi, Anita. Well,
hi, how are you doing?
Great.
Good. I was wondering about a deficiency in calcium, and also when you start to lose estrogen, if that can have any type of bearing on creating heart palpitations.
Well, yes. I mean, calcium balance is involved in heart rhythm. So the question is, how much do you need to prevent that?
Anita?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the recommendation for women in 40s, 50s, and 60s is between 1,000 milligrams and 1,200 milligrams of calcium every day. And that works to, you know, maintain bone mass, but also to keep your heart healthy and all of the other functions that calcium is involved with, nerve signaling and muscle contractions. The question then is, well, what do you have to eat to get that much calcium? And here's a rule of thumb. Every serving of dairy or dairy alternatives like soy milk that's been fortified with calcium or orange juice that's been fortified with calcium, every one of those servings is about 200 milligrams. And then you get another 200 milligrams from just everything else you eat, the vegetables that you're eating, the grains, the beans and nuts. That all adds up to 200 and 250 milligrams. So that gives you just sort of a rule of thumb. Look at your diet and what you're taking in every day. How close to 1,000 are you getting?
Okay. All right, Anita, thanks for that question. Let's move on to the issue of protein. It's we thought we knew it, friend of all muscle groups, why? But there have been studies finding that young and middle-aged people eat too much protein and that older people don't get enough.
Yeah, these two studies came out virtually the same week. It's one of those things that gives you sort of nutritional whiplash, right?
Right.
Too much, not enough. I was very interested in these studies with older folks not getting enough protein. I think that's a really important health message that we can start to get out there, because here's what happens. As we get older, our calorie needs go down. Our metabolism slows down a little bit. We get a little bit less active. And, you know, appetite slows down. So, and I'm talking about people that are, you know, into their 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. So calorie needs go down, but protein needs do not go down. If anything, they go up. You need a little bit more protein to hang on to that all-important lean muscle tissue. So what that means is the portion of calories that you're getting from protein has to get higher as you're a senior. If you're just kind of cutting back on everything, your protein intake is going to sink too low. And I think we can, the study that came out of Japan showed that the men who were eating the most animal protein, so that's fish, eggs, also meat and poultry, they had the slowest rates of physical and cognitive decline. And I think that's a real opportunity. We want to make sure our seniors are getting enough protein.
What are the benefits of protein consumption in people over 60, the same as they are with anybody, right?
Well, the thing, they are the same, but the thing is that as we get older, we tend to lose muscle mass. It's called age-related sarcopenia. It's
yeah.
a big deal. And as we as we lose muscle mass, we start to lose bone strength, and it's that kind of downward spiral. And so the protein helps defend against that natural loss of lean muscle tissue, also a little bit of exercise. And protein also helps keep the immune system robust. And that's another thing that we worry about as folks get older, is that the immune system isn't quite as responsive. So those are the two primary things that protein helps with in aging. And I think what happens is people start to eat less protein as they get older. Maybe they're not cooking as much,
mm-hmm.
and so they're more likely to just open a can of soup for dinner,
mm-hmm.
you know, or even have like a bowl of cereal and not be having a lean chicken breast or some egg white omelet or something like that. They're just not getting as much protein, or maybe they're having trouble with their teeth or their dentures, and so they're not eating meat. So, you know, this is a real wake-up call, I think, for seniors and anyone who loves seniors, who takes care of seniors, to watch those protein intakes.
And just a lot of a big component of eating healthier in the United States involves smaller portions.
Mm-hmm.
You can get enough protein in a pretty small portion, let's say, of chicken. How much chicken is a good portion?
You know, I was looking at a cookbook that was published in the 80s the other day and realizing when they were giving their proportions how much larger chicken breasts have gotten in the last 20
years.
Oh,
everything's gotten bigger.
They're huge.
Yeah.
They're literally twice as big as they used to be. So you can take a boneless chicken breast, which is kind of the, you know, the standard, and
right.
cut that in half and still have two really good sized
okay.
servings.
And then take the skin off it and...
Yeah, take the skin off it. Or, you know, I've become a real fan of the boneless chicken thigh because they're a little bit more portion appropriate and they're, you know, they've got a nice, they're a little moister because the fat content is just a little bit higher.
Right.
And they're cheaper. Like, who doesn't love that?
I do. I love them. I absolutely agree. Okay, so we have time for maybe one other topic, mood and food.
Yeah,
you're doing a series on mood and food on your podcast, right? Tell me what inspired you in the first place.
I am, and what inspired me is we have a new member of our podcasting team, Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. She's a psychologist, and she and I were talking one day about all the connections between mood and food, and decided, oh, we need to team up. So we did a 3-part series, and we looked at it from both sides, both how your mood affects things like your appetite and your food choices. Turns out, when you're in a good mood, it's actually easier for you to make healthy food choices. So one strategy is, you know, do something that puts you in a good mood, whether it's, you know, going to Facebook and checking in with friends or, you know, calling a friend before you go and order lunch, and you're likely to make a healthier choice. But then also how nutrients affect mood the other way around. And Dr. Hendrickson was sharing some interesting research on fish oil. Eating more fish can actually help treat depression and ward off depression. And folic acid, which is in leafy greens like kale and collards and spinach and Swiss chard, also are connected with better mood states and a reduced risk of depression. I thought that was fascinating.
There was for a long time, a lot of us thought that eating carbs was bad. You know, it was just empty calories. Now there's a connection between carbs and a good mood, too.
And you know, Judith Wortman has done a lot of work with this, and she advises eating a 100% carb snack to boost your mood. And she's got some research to show that it elevates serotonin levels, but I got to tell you, Anne, I'm not a fan of this approach because I think that there's a downside to eating a lot of carbs. And I think you can get the same effect by taking a brisk walk, by doing a favor for someone, you know, by stretching. I think that there are other ways that it may work, but I think there are other ways to boost your mood that don't have the potential consequences. So I'm not a fan of the serotonin diet.
Okay. We have an email from Kelly. I'm curious about this. She says, I am active 38-year-old female, and I was recently diagnosed with a pelvic stress fracture. Mm. She asks if there are dietary changes she can make to help healing. She's a vegetarian.
Hmm. That's an interesting question. Well, she certainly does want to watch her protein intake as a vegetarian because they tend to be on the lower side. And it's... another one of those Goldilocks situations. Mm-hmm. Too much protein can accelerate calcium loss, but you need a certain amount of protein to build bone tissue. So you want to make sure you keep your protein up. And then, you know, all of those bone-building nutrients that we talked about before, vitamin D, vitamin K, calcium, yes, but also magnesium and potassium. And here she's got an advantage as a vegetarian because she's probably eating a wide range of vegetables, and that's mm-hmm. going to help her cover that spectrum. But yeah, that stress fractures, that's about usually about overuse. So also she's going to have to find the discipline to rest it.
You know, Monica, I was wondering, as a nutritionist, are you frustrated that when someone's diagnosed with something like a pelvic stress fracture, that the issue of diet doesn't come up in the course of the conversation with a physician?
I know that physicians are pressed for time.
Yes.
And, you know, but yes, it is frustrating. It's especially frustrating for me when people have digestive issues like reflux or, you know, things that are so dietary related and there doesn't seem to be time to talk about diets. I know that physicians are up against the wall in terms of, you know, how much time
how much
they can
more
spend
can they talk about,
patient education. But no, it is frustrating. I wish I could put a nutritionist in every physician's office to catch that person on the way out and talk about that.
Well, we didn't get to everything, so that means we have to have you back again.
Oh, well, that would be my pleasure.
Okay. Monica Reinagle, she's chef, author, and the Nutrition Diva. You can get her podcast if you go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, who produces Wellness Wednesday, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.